Thank you for listening to audio from Midway Mennonite Church. You can also listen to our sermons each week by subscribing to the Midway Mennonite Podcast. If you live in the Mahoning County or Columbiana County area, we'd love for you to come engage with our faith community. For directions and worship times, visit us at Facebook or at MidwayMennonite.com. Thanks for listening.
I'll be reading from Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, and later on then Luke 15, 11 through 31. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathered around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." 11 through 31. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, throwing his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the servants, 'Quick, bring him the best robe and put on it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and a celebration. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come home,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back home safe.' The older son became angry and refused to go in. So the father went out and pleaded with him. But he asked his father, 'Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours has abandoned your property, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, came home, you killed a fatted calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours.'"
Missed the very end of that parable, so we'll catch it up, though. All right, good morning. So if you're just joining us, we're in a series called Stories from the Road. And what we're doing in this series is we're looking at stories, parables that Jesus told as he traveled from Galilee, where he began his ministry, to Jerusalem, where his ministry would end. And in the middle is Samaria. And as we talked about, it's not a direct route, but Luke presents this as Jesus is traveling through Samaria and he's telling these stories. This one falls almost exactly in the middle of the travel narrative, so which is kind of interesting. And then I don't know if there's any parable better known among people than this parable. I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think it's a great short story. It's easy to listen to. It's easy to be engaged by. It's not hard to understand. So what's interesting to me is this parable told 2,000 years ago, Middle Eastern context. You can pull it out of that context and you can plop it here, Northeast Ohio, 2,000 years later, And for the most part, you basically understand it. Like even if this was the first time you ever came to church, ever heard about the Christian story, the New Testament, you would generally understand what's happening here. And the challenge that like us preachers have is that when you preach on the parables, you always risk kind of doing damage by over-explaining a story. So it's like a joke, right? If you have to explain it, it loses all its power. So we have that on the one hand, but on the other hand, this is such a rich parable. You know, there may be no parable where we could spend more time on theological reflection than this parable. There's one scholar named Ken Bailey who spent about 40 years in the Middle East as a missionary and a New Testament scholar and everything, and he's almost kind of made this parable his life's work. This is a guy, it's 40 years has been thinking about this parable and is still not done thinking about it. So let's look at the story. Let's make sure we at least understand it. Let's dig a little deeper into some of the cultural background. I had Rich read the first two verses because I want to make sure you know where we are here. Jesus is telling this story to two groups of people. We've got the tax collectors and the sinners. That's one group. Second group, we've got the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. So one group, good, moral, upright, religious, right? Models of upright behavior. And the other one is the opposite of that. Kind of, it's interesting because Jesus brings these two groups together, right? Like, usually these two groups want nothing to do with each other. Like, the group that's doing the judging and the group that feels judged, neither one of them really want to be around each other. Jesus is a rabbi. He's a brilliant teacher. I think even though he's stirring up lots of things with controversial statements and teachings, I think a lot of these Pharisees and teachers of the law are probably generally interested in hearing what Jesus has to say. And then, of course, Jesus attracts outcasts everywhere he goes. It's always the outcasts that are coming close to Jesus. So we have this strange combination of people that are together. And the Pharisees are grumbling about this. They don't like that Jesus is hanging out with these sinners and tax collectors. So he tells these three stories. So kind of know this parable is in the context of several stories about what is lost and then is found. We've got the lost sheep, we've got the lost coin, and now we have the lost son. And as Rich mentioned, so often we think about this as one son, right? The prodigal son, the most well-known title for this passage. But I think a better name is probably prodigal sons, lost sons, and we'll talk about that because as we get into it, we see really that there's actually two lost sons in here. And the way the parable's told, it's told in two acts. So act one is the story of the younger brother, and act two is the story of the elder son. And we'll start with act one. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So a couple things here. Our ears, we know something's not quite right here. Right, so like my parents and Christian's parents over the years since we've got married, they've helped us out a number of times financially, and sometimes you might have said this to your own kids. Sometimes they say, "Hey, we're going to either give it to you now or when we're dead." Right? I don't know if you've ever heard that, but my parents are selling their house right now, and it's on the market, and there'd be something different about me calling them up and saying, "As soon as that's sold, I'll take my share now." Like, go ahead, here's my bank account, go ahead once that sale is done, and just go ahead and send that to me. Something doesn't sound quite right about that. And then, so we need to add even more surprise, this request. When the original audience would have heard this request for the inheritance, it would have been, like, much more surprise and shock. This is not what children did. You know, what he's doing, basically, is essentially saying, drop dead. Maybe not quite that harsh, somewhere in between wishing his father would die and drop dead, somewhere kind of right there. Because, and this is a really interesting revealing request, because what this reveals about the son is he's not really interested in the father. He's primarily interested in what the father has to offer him. And so what he's saying is, I want your things, I want what you can give me, I don't care that much about you. But just as surprising is the father's response. So what a number of people say is that, especially in traditional cultures, when they hear this parable, they're like, Man, that father, he should have beat that child and kicked him out of the house. Like, that is not what sons do. But what does the father do? He divided his property between them. So some of you might know this. The way this worked is usually the older son got a double portion of the inheritance. And part of that was because the older son was typically had more responsibility for the parents. So in this case, if we've got two sons in the story, two-thirds go to the older son, one-third goes to the younger son. But hear how this literally reads. This is where the Greek is really helpful. It says, he divided to them the life. So we have this word bios in Greek, means life, living, livelihood. He divided them the life. So go back to this hypothetical request to my parents. If I ask for this request, it's offensive. It's not a threat to my parents' well-being financially if they were to give me this inheritance now. But when the younger son asked this, he asked for his share of the property, the estate. He's asking for the father to give up what is intended to maintain his life in his old age. And here's what I want you to see about it. This is what we really need to kind of hear this cultural context, is that the son is basically asking the father to tear apart his life. The son is asking the father to tear apart his life, and the father does it. Story continues. Younger son takes off, heads to a distant country, squanders his wealth and wild living, and things go downhill really fast. He finds himself in this foreign land. So for a Jewish person to find themselves in a foreign land and now having to hire themselves out to a foreign master, this is bad. And then it gets worse. He then is sent out by this person to go feed pigs, which for a Jewish person is the lowest of lows. This is utterly degrading for him. So it's at this point that the son comes to his senses. He has this moment of realization. And he realizes the hired hands at his father's farm have it better than this. They at least have food to eat. So we read that the son had gone to this distant country. He's coming back, and he's got this really well-crafted apology. He's working out. I mean, he's got all this time. He's walking back to think about this moment when he delivers the apology. Gets close, father sees him far away. Father sets off in a sprint, throws his arms around the son and kisses him. Now here's what you need to know about this scene. This is absolutely not what Middle Eastern fathers do in this culture. This is utterly undignified behavior. So first, just a few things. First, he leaves the house. So the father, the patriarch, to leave the house to go out would not be common. The father runs rather than walks, not common because... And then also the father shows this emotion. So all these actions, when the original audience is hearing, these are all very undignified actions. So let me just take a couple of these, the running. So like, what's the deal with running? Well, when you run and you're wearing the clothes at that time, it exposes your legs. And you can say, well, what's the big deal with showing your legs? Well, my personal experience, when I lived in West Africa for 2 years, in that culture, a lot of traditional cultures, men did not show their legs. If you wear shorts, which a lot of Americans did, that's what kids wear. I mean, you might wear shorts when you're playing sport, but you don't wear shorts out in public. I spent a little over two years in that culture, and that so influenced me that if I go out in public today, 15 years later in shorts, I have this feeling of being like a little kid. I'm not saying it's wrong to wear shorts. I'm just saying, like, I feel like a little kid. I was in that culture for 2 years. And it left that deep of an impression for me. So think about it. This is the only culture you know. Men do not show their legs. And then think about the emotion the father shows. So I don't even think you have to understand this culture. Like, for those of you who are 60 and older, and this won't be the case for all of you, but I'll just speak from what I've heard. Think about your own dad. Would your dad have done this? I'm not asking, did your dad love you? I'm asking, would your dad have done this? Would your dad have run out and shown this kind of public emotion and affection? Like, for some of you, your dad's just not going to do it. You know, it's not that your dad didn't love you, but that's just not what dads did. So think about this. This is surprising. I just want you to kind of feel the surprise of this scene. Father runs out. Youngest son is all ready. Pulls out the speech. Gives it, Father, I've sinned against heaven and you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. What does the father do? The father just completely ignores the speech. Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. So all these actions, the robe, the sandals, this is all symbolizing the reinstatement of the younger son as a son. He's not going to have none of this hired servant stuff. He's going to be a son. Kill the fattened calf, and the communal celebration begins. And then Act 1 ends, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So that's Act 1. That's the story of the younger son. Act 2. I'm going to read it here. I had a slide that was going to read it because I just want to remind us. So Act 2. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what he was going on. Your brother has come, he replied. And your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. So this is interesting. Notice how the father, this is something that you miss. The father goes out and pleads with the second son. This is not normal. It's not normal for the father to go out and plead with the first, or to greet the first son. Not normal for the patriarch to go out of the house and plead with the older son. Okay, verse 29-30. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you have never given me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. So you feel the anger coming out. Feel the vitriol coming out. There's something pent up that is coming out at this point. And we see it in all these ways. First is the address, the look. Very blunt address, something like, look you, all these years I've been slaving for you. This is interesting. The older son in this speech has stopped seeing himself as a son. He sees himself as a servant and never disobeyed your orders. The younger son has gone off and done everything a son shouldn't do. Squandered property, been with prostitutes, abandoned responsibility for the care of his father. In other words, this son has been very bad. Elder son, on the other hand, has done everything a good son should do. Stays home, obeys the father's orders, cares for the father's estate, is very good. But when this son, notice this is interesting too, like the older brother doesn't even call him brother anymore. It's like, this is your son. When the son comes back, you kill the fattened calf. Now, there's like this obsession with this fattened calf. Like, if you know, it's like a third time we've heard about this fattened calf, and you're like, what is the deal with this fattened calf? Well, back then, meat was a delicacy. It's not something you ate every day. Let me go back to my time in West Africa. It helps me to understand a more traditional culture. But what you slaughtered was showed you how big of a celebration it was. So if it was your birthday or it was a Sunday, a chicken would be kind of what you'd slaughter. And then if you're going to raise the bar, one time we did this, my family from the United States all came and visited me in Benin, and it was a big deal. Like, we went to a tailor and all had, like, clothes made of the same cloth. It's crazy to think about. You can't, how much that would cost here in the country, but it was very cheap then. And we went and got a goat. So a friend and I, we drove down to Port Nova, the capital south of us. We buy a goat. We load it on top of a bush taxi, drive it back to Sokoté, where I lived, and we invited lots of people to come celebrate. It was a big deal. There was drums. There was the slaughter of the goat. It fed lots of people. I never have any memory of a calf being killed, because a calf is almost at a level, it has to be a huge celebration. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people. Because remember, there's no refrigeration. There's no freezing. The meat that you slaughter then, it's going to be eaten right then. So it means you have lots of people there. So to kill the calf, the fattened calf, I mean, that is where it just seems like it really hits the older brother. And you can just feel the anger coming out. You can feel him, the injustice. And so the father listens to it all. Notice that there's these two speeches, and notice the father doesn't cut this one off. He cuts off the son's confession, but the angry diatribe, he stands there, he listens. Patiently, he takes it, and he responds, my son, you're always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Then it ends. Right? What happens? This is what we always ask. Does the older brother join the celebration? Does the older brother stay outside and rest in his stubbornness and bitterness and anger? We never find out. Can you display that painting? Let's see here. I might turn off lights here. Just leave this up for a while, Larry. This is in your bulletin too if you want to see it. This is a painting by the Dutch artist Rembrandt, and it's called The Return of the Prodigal Son. He painted it near the end of his life. I think he died within 2 years of painting this. It's considered a masterpiece. I mean, this might be a stretch, but there's a few people as I was researching this painting that say there is no finer painting than this. And of course, that's biased, but that's what some people think. It depicts the moment of the younger son's return home. And Rembrandt takes a little bit of liberty. We've got the younger son, the father, and then we got the older son here. So the story doesn't put those all three in the same scene, but Rembrandt brings them together. And what I want to do is I want to just take each of these characters and just reflect for a little bit on each of them. Okay, let's start with the younger son. You can just leave this up here. So look at the head. I was so struck by the head. I could not stop looking at the head of the younger child, younger son. He's shaved. It's shaved. His body is emaciated. His clothes are torn. He's actually disposed of basically everything. There's a little sword that sits right here on his belt that you might be able to see. That's basically what he's got. I think Rembrandt masterfully depicts what we just read. It's a ruined and repellent outcast of a son who has sunk to the lowest of lows. He's dirty. He's a failure. He's degraded himself. He's brought shame on the family. He has, as we talked about, torn apart the life of his father. He is, the younger son is the embodiment of traditional understanding of sin. And amidst all that pain, the son's head rests, peacefully buried in the bosom of the father. This is probably the most, as I was looking at this pain, this is probably the most moving part for me. Because what I see in his face is both peace and just exhaustion. And what came to my mind was when, and some of you parents will probably remember this, when I had little kids, my kids were all smaller, there'd be these times at night where they would just fight and fight and fight to not go to bed. And often one of the parents would take the child and you'd start walking and walking, and often the fight, and then just this peace. And the son or daughter's head would be resting on there. It's just amazing how quickly they went from the fighting to this peaceful repose on your chest. That's what I kept thinking about. The son has returned. He's not just returned home. He's returned to the father. And we know this story. We know this story. But we can't let the familiarity take away the marvel at God, the vastness of God's grace and mercy for those who have run away and come back. There is no place that we can run from God. There's no low that we can sink that far. There's no action that's so repugnant that we cannot stop and turn back and come to our senses and go back to the Father, realizing that the Father is scanning the horizon, waiting for you to come back. This is good news. Okay? We need to remember this. It's familiar, but it's always good news. Let's turn to the elder brother. He's here to the right. Rembrandt depicts him with his arms crossed. And remember, there's two acts to the story. I think sometimes I don't know for sure, but in my experience with this parable, often the second act is kind of like the bonus lesson. It's like, hey, remember, don't be a sour big brother, right? This is your younger brother's story, but you also look bad in this. But that's not really the way it's structured. I mean, certainly the younger brother is a central part of the story, but it ends with the older brother, meaning that primarily the focus is on Act 2 of the older brother. And that's what we're left thinking about. What happens? What happens to the older brother? Because in all the other parables, the object is found. The coin is found, celebration. The sheep is found, celebration. We never have this other factor that's in the story. Remember, there's two lost sons here. The Dutch Catholic priest and professor Henry Nouwen came across this painting, I think in the 80s, And he was so moved by this painting that he wrote a whole book on it. And now it's actually in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg now, but now I just went there and just stared at it for hours. And in contemplating this, he realized there's two conversions here that need to happen. There's the conversion of the younger son, but then there's also the conversion of the older son. And Nouwen says, in the story and in the depiction by Rembrandt, he thinks by far the harder conversion is for the one who stayed home. Let me say that again. There's two conversions that need to happen in the story. And Nouwen, I think I agree with him, the harder conversion is the older brother. There's two sons that are alienated from the father. There's the one who moves to the distant country and squanders property with prostitutes, and there's the one who stays home and obeys all the rules. Now, both are alienated. Both need healing and forgiveness. Both need conversion. So what kind of conversion does the older brother need? Like, what does he even need to repent of? Remember, he says, I obeyed all the rules. At the end of the story, we have one son who disobeyed, who broke all the rules. He's in the celebration. The other son has obeyed all the rules, and he's out. He's left out. He's out of the celebration. The younger son is in. The elder son is out. It's not just that the elder son is disapproving of what's happening. The elder son, as far as we know, is out. He's standing on the outside of the celebration. And remember, so Jesus is telling this story to the Pharisees. He's giving them a picture of what this looks like. Both groups are lost, the sinners and the tax collectors, and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. But both are lost in different ways. The younger son's lost in his badness, and the older son's lost in his goodness. Let me say it again. Both sons are lost. Both sons are alienated from the heart of the father. Both sons are in need of conversion, but one is lost because of his badness and one because of his goodness. So why is the elder son lost? Well, for one thing, this facade of the older son has been pierced. So we saw very blatantly that the younger son, what he really wanted mostly was his father's things. But now we're seeing that the older son has a similar thing with him. He seems to feel that there's a contract relationship. And the older son is very clear that I did all my part. I obeyed the rules, and you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. You didn't give me what I deserve, what I earned. See, there's really two sons that are trying to wrest control of their father's property. One by living a good life, and one by living a bad life. And the younger son, he's got to learn how to lay down his deadly badness. We get that. For the most part, the elder son has to learn how to lay down his deadly goodness. That's harder to get your mind around. The humble one is in and the proud is out. We got to keep going back to that too, because we know this is an easy path to go down. Most of us have been in church our whole lives. We know the path of self-righteousness, right? It is so easy to follow all the rules, to be very busy as a Christian, to be very involved in committees and work, and be very far from the heart of God. And the reason why this conversion is so hard is because it's so hard to see. At the moment, you're like the older brother. You think you're doing everything right, and yet your heart is far from the heart of God because you're doing all this stuff for the wrong reasons. You're not doing this stuff. You're not obeying God because you want God. You're obeying God because you want what you think God has to offer you, whether that be heaven or whether that be material blessings in this life. You're loving God for the wrong reasons. And that when something happens in your life, like what happened to your older brother, that's where it gets exposed. When it becomes clear that God has not held up his end of the bargain, that's where the facade crumbles. He's followed all the rules, yet he's far from the heart of God. But look at the father. Don't forget the father, because the father is amazing in this story. The father pleads with the older son. As I heard a preacher say, Jesus isn't self-righteous with the self-righous. That's why Jesus is so much better than all of us, right? Like, if we're not self-righteous, then we're self-righteous about the fact that we're not self-righteous. But not Jesus. Like, the thing Jesus wants most is for the Pharisees to come in. He's saying, look at the Father. He's pleading with them. Stop this. You're doing it for the wrong reason. Come in. Lay down your pride and come in and join the celebration. There's one more character. In many ways, this is the center of the painting. So the way the light comes in is that really I think Rembrandt wants us to focus right here, particularly on these hands, and we'll go back to those. One of the things that the story is doing is pushing us to reimagine the Father. In this parable, Jesus is giving us a very strange image of a Father. For them, maybe less so for us, but very strange for them. And for some of you, this might sound very strange to you. You had a Father who was harsh and condemning. You had a Father that no matter how much you obeyed the rules, it was never enough. You never lived up to those expectations. Some of you have a Father where you have no memory of any tenderness coming from your Father. No kind of affection. Certainly not the scene of putting his arms around and kissing him. And Jesus is saying, I'm sorry. That was how your Father treated you, but that's not what my Father's like. See, Jesus knows the Father. And Jesus is saying, look. You want to see what the Father looks like? This is what the Father looks like. Look at the painting with me. Look at the Father. Look at a couple things here. Look at the red cloak. A lot of people that have commented say it's like the wings of a bird that are bringing you back in. They're surrounding the younger son. And then look at the hands. The hands are often noted as one of the most interesting things about the painting. You can't see it from here, but you've got one hand, the left hand, which is strong and muscular. The fingers are spread out and they're grasping. The right hand is refined, it's soft, it's tender. What many people have said is that these two hands represent both the hand of a father and the hand of a mother. Strong and tender hands. These are the hands of the Father, the hands in which mercy and reconciliation and healing are found. So some of you see the younger son here and you say, I get that. Maybe more of us, we see the elder son and we say, I get that. Some of us, like Nouwen and Rembrandt, see ourselves in both the sons. And then I guess there's some people here who maybe see that, but they're at a point in their life where they see themselves most in the place of the Father. Some of you, like the Father, have had your lives torn apart by prodigal sons and daughters. When the Father says, you have divided my life, you know exactly what that means. You know what it's like to have love scorned by a child. You know what the decisions of that child have felt like they've ripped your life apart. In Rembrandt's painting, the Father looks exhausted too. We think about the Father celebrating, and of course I imagine the Father was exhausted by all the years of scanning the horizon for his son. Some of you are exhausted from scanning the horizons for prodigal sons and prodigal daughters. See, something I think we miss in the celebration is that this has come at a cost. It has come at an emotional cost for the father and the elder son. It has come at a huge cost to resources. Family land, family possessions are never coming back. They've been squandered. Remember the father's words, my life has been divided. My life has been ripped apart. And yet the father maintains love for the son. After all the pain and cost, how does the father respond when the son comes back? Does he get that apology he deserves? He doesn't even want to hear the apology. Does he say, you can come back, but you're going to pay your dues for the costs you caused? You're going to get the silent treatment at best. No. He reinstates the son. He doesn't withhold the love. He buries the son in his bosom, in his affection. I don't know what that feels like from personal experience, but I've heard some of your stories, and I know that scanning horizons can be really, really hard. Scanning horizons can be maybe the hardest thing that you do in your life. And I realize that that has cost you greatly. I also realize that prodigal sons and daughters sometimes come back and then they leave. But in the compassionate Father, you have a model here. Never give up. Never stop scanning horizons. Never stop being ready to extend forgiveness, even at great cost to yourself. Welcome the child back home. Younger brothers, the stuff you're chasing, the stuff the world is telling you to chase after, pleasure and money, it ultimately ends up in emptiness and distance from the Father. It ultimately ends up asking, is that all there is? Come to your senses. Return home. That's where you belong. Older brothers, are you comfortable with a God who acts foolishly in his love displayed in this parable? Are you comfortable with a God whose grace is so vast that it can be offensive to our sense of justice? Get comfortable with that God, because that's who he is. Are you going to repent of your self-righteousness? Lay down your deadly goodness. Join the celebration. That's where you belong. Parents of prodigal sons and daughters, never give up scanning horizons. Be compassionate, just as your Father is compassionate with you. Just as the Father has been compassionate with us. Just as the Father has borne great cost. Be compassionate.